Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
Welcome to Big Pop Fun, the podcast with your host, Tom Wilson, and guests from every corner of places that you know, Tom has been and who he asked to be on his show. Brought to you by Tom's Art at BigPopFun.com. Moving pictures to make you happy. Hey, support the arts by buying art. Big Pop Fun. Tom, life, showbiz, people. Here's Tom.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition, another episode, another joyful podcast. It's the Big Pop Fun podcast with Tom Wilson. I am Tom Wilson, your tall, yet not too tall, host, bringing you a magical sleigh ride of entertainment, enchantment, and wonder as we ride over the hilltops of Kansas City, Missouri, where you find me right now, although there aren't hilltops in Kansas City, Missouri, because I'm looking out my window of the hotel, and there is not a hill to be found. I'm looking at a small pond that's in kind of an industrial place that's near the airport. It's festive and joyful and sort of industrial and somewhat cementy. I always seem to come to cities right as gigantic festivals or some kind of concert that everyone has to go and enjoy are there while I'm trying to sell tickets to the show. And Kansas City is no different. I remember going to where I think it was Cleveland, Ohio, and I was performing there. And, you know, you get greeted at the airport by someone picking you up who greeted me sort of with a grimace. Hey, how you doing? Yeah, it's going to be – oh, no, it'll be fine. But Carrot Top is doing a concert that's two blocks from us, and Lyle Lovett and his large band – is also performing for the weekend. That's about a half mile away. So, yay, good luck, though. We're going to have eight people come, and they're going to have fun. No, the people who come to see you, Tom, they're going to have a great time, you know, in their own way. So I got to Kansas City and found out this is the weekend of something called the American Royal. I mean, that's pretty, you know, when you call it the American Royal, that's big stuff. It is a barbecue festival of Kansas City. Kansas City, as many of you I'm sure know, is already known as the barbecue capital of this section of Missouri or something. It's known for its barbecue, as many places are, let's face it. But in Kansas City, barbecue is king, and this is the American Royal Weekend, where all of Kansas City is taken over by those small tents that you put up at every food festival where there's a band playing a little too loudly and food, which is, you know, it's not really on sale, let's admit. It's kind of pricey. It's often good, sometimes not so much, but this is a barbecue festival to end all barbecue festivals, and it's going on, and everyone in Kansas City and its environs has to go to the American Royal to celebrate this barbecue. Can I admit, I think I've even talked about it on the podcast before. Hey, I love barbecue food, and everywhere has pretty good barbecue. I mean, if you cook meat reasonably well and slather it with this sauce that's pretty good, with some, you know, who knows what, I don't, you know, maple syrup or ketchup or bacon, but I don't know. But you mix up a big goop and you put it on reasonably well-prepared meat. I just think it's good. But everywhere that I've gone, everyone's, oh, well, you got to go to Big Fat Junior's for the barbecue. Well, you got to go to the big, you know, ceiling staring Mike. I don't know where you go, but you have to. In Birmingham, Alabama, you go to this place for barbecue. In Texas, you go to the other place. In East Carolina, they have that vinegary barbecue. To me, I'm not saying it's bad at all. I'm just saying, you know, I have a pretty sophisticated palate, but it tastes about the same. It's very good. That's a fine, fine brisket of beef sandwich with sauce on it. Pretty much like I have in California. So you know, I mean, I like barbecue, and good luck to everyone at the American Royal and all of their sauces. Best prize brisket, best preparation of a burnt chicken over, I don't know what, but that's going on in Kansas City. And though I wish everyone the best of luck, I have barbecue when I feel like barbecue, and it's always pretty good. I did have bad beef jerky this week, though. I went to get my little snacks. You're in a hotel room for the weekend, a number of days. So you go and you get a little trail mix or you get something like that. And I'm not a huge beef jerky fan, but this convenience store really didn't have much. So I got a little bit of trail mix. You know, trail mix is so expensive now. And then so I see beef jerky at the counter, and I'm thinking, well, I just got a little bit of trail mix, and the trail mix is like $5. So I just plop down the beef jerky. The beef jerky was like $6.99 or something. So what? It's not a whole lot of beef jerky. But anyway, it was there, and the guy had rung it up, so I bought the beef jerky, and I came back to the hotel. As I say, I'm not crazy about beef jerky to begin with, but I opened the beef jerky, and I mean, it was like rocks. Utterly stale beef jerky. So what do I do? Do I take the beef jerky and actually walk the few blocks to the convenience store to return it and get my money back? Of course not. It was expensive beef jerky. It's horrible beef jerky. But now I'm just punishing myself for the rest of the weekend eating rock hard beef jerky because I was stupid enough to buy beef jerky in the first place when I'm not really that crazy about beef jerky. So I'm just punishing myself for an impulse buy of bad beef jerky by holding rock hard beef jerky in my mouth until it softens up and, tastes generally like barbecue at the American Royal here in Kansas City. I got to Kansas City. The temperature difference was remarkable. I left my house. It was 106 degrees. I came to Kansas City. It was 52 degrees. It's still not winter, but it was 52 degrees. I didn't pack a jacket and everything. So that's another way that I'm punishing myself with bad beef jerky. And I'm saying I'm so sick and tired of buying jackets in cities when I forget a jacket that I'm not buying a jacket. So, but it feels good, actually. It does feel good. I was outside. It was 52 degrees. Fall is coming to Kansas City. I was walking to the convenience store on my way to get my horrible beef jerky that I'm punishing myself for by continuing to eat it. And I passed by a crabapple tree. And there, hanging on one of the branches on a crisp fall day, 52 degrees, was just a beautiful crabapple. It was. It was hanging in front of my face. It was almost purplish, like a lavender into a rose color. A little bit of yellow on the bottom, just ripe, about the size of my palm. And I took it off the tree. And there I am, standing there in the Kansas City sunshine, looking at this crabapple and marveling at its colors, at the changing shades of the colors as I turned it in my hand. And I realized I had nothing to throw it at. Because crabapples, as we know, are not for eating. They're for throwing at things. Hopefully people. Ideally, your brother, who is not looking and who can be walking, let's say, 20 feet ahead of you, and you throw it at their head, and right before it gets there, you go, "Hey, Brian," and they turn. Okay, hopefully it doesn't hit them in the eye. With my luck, it probably hits them in the eye and blinds them. But you hope you just get a nice upper shoulder shot. And you laugh. But I found that with security cameras outside every store now and building in Kansas City, and, being an adult now, you just can't haul off and throw a reasonably sized crab apple at people or even at cars or at buildings. There was nothing to throw the crab apple at. So there I am holding a useless crab apple, and I actually brought it back to my hotel room to just stare at it. And, I'm not bringing it back to California. I have no one to throw it at. I'll throw it out eventually, but it looked nice, nice colors. And Kansas City is wonderful. I'm having a great time. Everyone is very nice here. Everyone is kind of sad about their sports teams, which is, I don't care, really. I don't care if the Chiefs stink, But everyone in Kansas City really seems to be very upset about it, because within 8 seconds of you introducing yourself, you go, oh, those Chiefs are going to get clobbered, whatever. And the Royals in baseball, that's fine. That's a fine team. I like the Royals. I like their uniform. They're kind of a light blue. They look nice. I've been to Royals games when I'm out here. I always enjoy it. But here we are in Kansas City, sad about their sports teams, happy about their barbecue, and celebrating by coming out to the Improv here in Kansas City, where I'm performing with actually a wonderful young comedian named Mary Patterson. Mary Patterson is from Alabama. She is a feature act. She's, well, they used to call it the middle. The middle, we talk about it, I think, in our conversation, but there's an opener and then a middle act, or now we call it feature comedian, and then the headliner. So Mary Patterson is a really up-and-coming young comedian who she quit her day job 2 weeks ago. Yes, 2 weeks ago in order to enter the comedy insane asylum, which most of the time it is. So she's given up. She's one of those people. And there are many out there who've taken the comedy classes, who've gotten up on stage, who've done many open mics, but she's given up the regular paycheck just now. And she's hit the road to make a living on stage. And to me, that takes a lot of guts and determination. Well, for anybody to do that. And I thought it would be interesting to talk to her. I hope you enjoy my conversation with young, new, excited, and vibrant comedian Mary Patterson.
It's Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson.
Mary Patterson is here on the podcast. Stage name, Mary Patterson.
Yes.
Real name, Broom. Mary Broom.
Patterson Broom.
Mary Patterson Broom.
Yeah, Mary Patterson's a double name.
Oh, is it really?
It's like Mary Catherine or Mary Elizabeth. So my whole life I was called Mary Patterson, and then moved to LA and it just got difficult. People didn't really get it.
Is it there a dash in it or just one
no
word?
No dash.
No even dash.
No dash. It's technically my first and middle name, which in the South it's very common. I went to high school with a Mary Riley, a Mary Gordon, a Mary Ross. It's the first name Mary, second name kind of sounds like a last name thing.
Uh-huh. Like Buddy Joe.
Exactly.
Or whatever.
Yeah, like Peggy Sue.
Yeah, Peggy Sue.
Exactly.
Wow. Okay. So you've gone Mary Patterson for career reasons.
For career reasons, I am phasing out the Broom.
Uh-huh.
And it's funny because in LA when I first started, I was really adamant about keeping it Mary Patterson Broom, and I trained all these LA comics. Then I started doing the road and I just decided to be simpler to drop the Broom.
Mm-hmm.
No one wants to put Mary Patterson Broom on a marquee. It's too long.
That's true.
It's too long.
When you make a decision like that, I've always wondered, how long does it take before you're completely used to people introducing you and saying, and here's Mary Patterson?
You don't get used to it. It's still weird.
You never do?
Not really. I haven't yet, but it hasn't been that long.
Tom Cruise is still like, Cruise? Really?
Wait, did he drop his name?
I think Cruise is like a made-up thing.
Really?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I'm sure
a lot of people have those made, you know, showbiz. I should have named myself, you know, Fireball Johnson or something. You know, one of those when comics were everything.
But Tom Wilson's a solid name.
It is a solid name. But Woodrow Wilson, our president, his actual name was Tom Wilson, and he thought it was so boring.
That he changed it to Woodrow?
No, Woodrow was his middle name.
Oh.
So he thought, Tom Wilson, nobody will remember that. So I'm just going to go with Woodrow. So he went with Woodrow Wilson because he dissed the name Tom Wilson. I just went because I was kind of, I think, in a weird way, I was just like, look, it's my name. Let's get over this. Just either call me that. If you're not interested in remembering it, don't remember it, okay?
Yeah.
I'm just doing my show.
Well, you know, for me, it's actually more getting used to people calling me Mary and not Mary Patterson, just in conversation.
Oh, because in the South, they would
South calls me Mary Patterson. Yeah, and all my close friends call me Mary Patterson or MP. And so it's getting used to the people calling me Mary, which is fine. It shouldn't be weird, but it's more getting used to that than getting used to being announced as Mary Patterson.
Well, interestingly, in the first 5 minutes of our talking on the podcast, I'm feeling guilty about calling you Mary.
Oh, I didn't mean to make you feel guilty.
No, a little bit you did. Just a little bit.
Well, I introduced myself to you as Mary because I'm trying to get used to it, I think, when
I'm just glad we're clear that the blame is on you.
Yeah, completely on me.
So you grew up where in the South?
Mobile, Alabama.
Really?
Yeah.
No accent whatsoever. Was that worked on?
I always did theater and speech in high school and college. And then I've just lived in California for 7 years. So
where'd you go to high school?
I went to a private school in St. Paul's Episcopal. Do you know the high schools?
Of course, St. Paul's Episcopal of Mobile. Not the St. Paul's Episcopal of Ottawa, Canada.
No.
That's no, I don't. I'm sorry, I don't. But it was a private school in Mobile. So
yes.
Did everyone speak with thick Southern accents?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, again, I got the acting bug really young and just started taking acting classes and speech classes. And so I had a speech teacher that was very adamant. She always said, if you ever get a microphone stuck in your face and it's a news team, you need to be able to say things like, I was there and it was lovely, as opposed to I was there and it was lovely. You know, she had a like instead of lack and all that stuff. I was trained really early on.
But you were trained specifically to be a witness of horrifying accidents.
Yes.
And being able to communicate what you saw clearly.
Well, because have you ever noticed after a hurricane or a big storm?
Well, that's true. Where they come to the South, I suppose.
People in the South, and you just, as a Southerner, you just put your head down just thinking, oh God, yeah. Why are they speaking that way? So she didn't want us to be one of those people.
No, that's good. That's good. No, I'm in the same vein. I mean, I'm from Philadelphia, and so many family members and people I know there, you know, talk with the Philadelphia accent,
uh-huh.
You know, and they're like this and whatnot, and I don't. So it was almost subconscious, I guess. It was just, I mean, I think I have a few Philadelphian words,
right?
Little things sneak in, which
same here,
to point
I think.
To that.
Well, and you know, I didn't think my accent was that thick in high school, but then college. I went to college in the South as well. But then I look at a stand-up tape I did when I first started in 2006, and I sound so much more Southern than I do now.
When you get back there, do you notice yourself?
Well, I have to. They make fun of me. They call me Yankee. They say I have a Yankee accent now. And I say, well, you know, I'm in California, not the Northeast. But anywhere in Southern Alabama, if you're anywhere north of Tennessee, Midwest, it's Yankee. It's considered Yankee.
It's good to know that those deep, deep-seated resentments are still alive.
Oh, yeah. As far as they're concerned, still Yankees.
Wow.
It's so bizarre.
I did a Civil War movie in Georgia, and everyone – the most important thing that everyone in Georgia needed to know was, where are you from?
Oh, yeah.
Like, not – good. Tom was whatever. Where are you from?
Right.
And really, to see them, their face change when I said Pennsylvania – was really quite something.
I know.
You know, really, because you just say, oh, Pennsylvania, grew up in Philadelphia, and you see that, you know, the cloud
right.
come over their features.
Right.
And you sort of want to go, dude, are you kidding?
You're a Yank, man,
as far as you're concerned. I just,
you know. As far as they're concerned.
It's a 1.5-hour flight.
Yeah.
It's not that, no, but they're still, yeah, they're still fighting it. So I actually began to say, I really did. By the end of the shoot, people were doing, where are you from? And I'd say, Pennsylvania, you know, the winners. They hated that, but it did end the conversation, you know, abruptly,
right?
Which is what I was interested in.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Growing up, everyone's very proud to be from there, and I had a wonderful upbringing and loved where I grew up. It wasn't until I left and spent some time elsewhere that I realized we're the butt of every joke. Alabama, we're like the redheaded stepchild of the country. I wasn't aware that we were made fun of so much growing up there.
You mean, and specifically within the South? Do Georgians make fun of Alabama? Do Louisianans?
I kind of feel like we're considered, you know, lesser than. Because, you know, Georgia has Atlanta and Tennessee has Nashville and...
Alabama has Birmingham.
Yeah, but Birmingham's not as, you know... I don't know why Alabama just gets the brunt of all the jokes. When you hear people doing inbred jokes or, you know, people are stupid and slow, it's always Bama. It's never Georgia or Mississippi.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
So, you went to college in Alabama?
No, I went to college in North Carolina.
Oh, okay.
I went to Wake Forest in Winston-Salem.
Great school.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what were you majoring in then? Were you doing plays and stuff?
Well, that's a whole – I wanted to be a theater major, but I didn't really – I kept auditioning, and they wouldn't cast me. And so I started doing sort of behind-the-scenes stuff and then got kind of pigeonholed into stage managing and, you know, prop master, that sort of thing. I didn't get cast.
In college or was that high school?
That was in college. In high school, I was, you know, star of the plays.
Oh, while doing all the shows.
Oh, of course.
All that stuff.
You're speaking Danny Oakley right here.
Are you kidding me?
Yes.
That's great.
Well, it turns out I haven't been able to ride that through. But no, college was very discouraging because I just didn't get cast in anything and I kind of got pigeonholed. And I just didn't really bond with the theater department at Wake Forest. And I finally got cast in a play at the end of my sophomore year. Then I went abroad the next semester. So I had to come back. And so I ended up majoring in political science and thought I was going to go to law school.
You left theater.
I started to major in theater, but I didn't want to spend all my time at the theater, and I felt like they weren't embracing me as an actress.
Is Wake Forest like one of those? And I don't know about the Wake Forest Theater Department, but I know about a lot of college theater departments.
Right.
They look at young actors training as sort of an intern in medicine. Like, you're just a servant of the graduate students. The graduate students will get all the roles and all the plays, and for 4 years, you're just going to carry costumes and work on lighting boards and stage manage and do all that stuff until we deem that the school has made enough money off you that will put you in a show.
No, it wasn't, because Wake Forest isn't that big. There wasn't like a graduate program. It was a very small school, like 3,500 undergrad. So
maybe you were just bad.
So it could have been that I was just bad. No. To this day, I wonder sometimes, I still love acting when I get the chance to do it, but I wonder if I'm better at performing than I am at acting, if that makes sense.
It does, yeah.
But, you know, I just felt like they kind of, you came in freshman year and they were like, okay, this girl's going to be the ingenue. This guy's going to be the quirky character. They kind of labeled everybody.
And you just got labeled as behind the scenes.
I mean,
you just, here's a ladder, honey.
Yeah, kind
of. Welcome aboard.
I mean, before they got to where like they would just assign me that before I'd even had the chance to audition. And so I just got upset and just felt like I'd rather do something else and not spend all my time here if it's not what I want to do.
Yeah. So I ended up for political science, weird kind of.
Well, my dad's a lawyer and he majored in political science. And I just thought, well, you know, I could go to law school. You know, that's what my dad did. That's what people my whole life, you know, if you don't do acting, you should go to law school.
Guess what my dad did?
What?
Mary Patterson.
What?
Guess.
Lawyer?
Yes. Guess what I studied?
Oh my God, I feel so close to you.
Guess what I studied?
Political science?
Yes.
I thought you majored in theater.
Well, no way. You kidding me?
Those
theater weirdos?
Oh my God,
hanging
the theater weirdos,
hanging
right?
Hanging out with them all the time?
I know.
I'm a lifer in showbiz because, you know, I had
Wait,
to recognize.
Are you joking? You did major in political science?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is cool. This is uplifting for me. Okay.
Yeah. But so, yes, it was that – it was. I think it was that thing of was your dad sort of verbal and erudite?
Yes.
Yes, he was, as was mine. So that maybe something about that led you into the, you know, thinking I have the ability to communicate with people.
Exactly. I've always wanted to get paid to talk because I've never –
I don't mind getting on a stage or behind a podium.
Exactly.
A microphone does not freak me out.
Exactly.
Why can't I stand up here and say something? I have as much right as anyone else.
Well, I've always been one of those people, and trust me, I'm not cocky about this because there's so many things I'm insecure about, but I am secure in that I've always been one of those people, for whatever reason, when I talk, whether it was in class or people listen, people seem to listen.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always just kind of had that, and I thought, I've always just wanted to make money doing what comes easy to me. And the talking in front of people has always been easy to me. In fact, I would rather sing, dance, tell jokes, all that in front of people before play sports in front of people. I have a phobia of playing sports in front of people.
What, did that come from
it came
doing
from,
badly when you were a kid? Or did you think, I just don't want to do it? Or?
Oh, it came from, you know, shooting at the wrong goal in basketball when I tried to play in sixth grade twice in one game. Twice in one game.
Congratulations.
Twice in one game, Tom. It came from being in the outfield in softball when I tried to play that, catching the ball and not knowing what to do with it and having people yelling at me on who to throw it to.
Yeah.
I don't like playing sports in front of people.
Yeah. I was playing basketball. I don't know what grade it was, but it was, you know, I don't know, fourth or fifth grade. And, you know, you're running to the one end of the court. You're trying to play defense. You're running up to the other end of the court and trying to shoot and everything. And the entire team was ignoring me so much that I just stopped running back and forth.
Oh, and you just stood there?
I literally was just standing still.
During the game, just
during
kind of
the
watching
game.
The game go by, but just, you were technically
were, yep,
in the game?
They were watching the game go by.
That sounds so traumatizing.
Yep, and I was just watching them go down there because just absolutely no one was paying attention to me or knew I was alive. So as I'm running down, and I'm a little kid, but I'm running with the things, you know, and kids have that, you know, I was just thinking, like, what kind of a sucker am I? I'm just running after these dudes who are not going to throw it to me. They're not looking at me because nobody cares.
Did you quit after that?
Yeah, I quit. Pretty soon after that, yeah. And I actually made a basket. because I was near the goal. I was near the, you know, the bat.
Just standing there.
And somebody passed to somebody, you know, and the ball kind of rolled down, but quickly.
Uh-huh.
So it runs to me, and a bunch of guys are running after it. So everyone, you know, pick it up, shoot the ball, Wilson, shoot it. So I just picked up the ball, and I mean, just threw it up toward the basket. And it was one of those, I mean, I remember it now. It was one of those that kind of bounced off the rim and circled the rim and bounced off the other side
and finally went in.
Finally went in.
Oh, my God.
And then did I get any credit whatsoever? No, even the coach, who was an adult, we lost that game, you know, and he said something like, come on, guys. I mean, even Wilson got a basket, and we know he's no good. You know, one of those kind of things.
Oh, God.
And that was, you know, that yes, the sports thing.
It was probably harder as a guy to not be good. Were you good at sports? Was there any sport you were good at?
No.
Because it's funny because my particular school I went to, athletics were really important to everybody. So I felt like I had to be good at – I thought at one point boys would never like me unless I was good at sports.
Yeah. Every guy I think goes through – that because there's a lot of pressure on guys.
Yeah.
So in high school, you know, you finally think, I'm gonna try to do something. I got to try, you know. So I went out for the wrestling team.
Yeah.
You know, and I was a terrible wrestler, but I was getting bigger, so I was kind of a strong kid.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So guys would wrestle me, and I couldn't win because I didn't know the moves. I didn't know how to pin them or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But if a guy grabbed me, I could, like, grab his arm and take it off me.
Right, right.
You know, so I could just, like, baby Huey.
You could stay in the game.
I could stay in the game.
You couldn't dominate the game.
You can't pin me.
Stay in it.
Yes. You could try to tackle me, but you can't because I'm big.
And did you do that all through high school?
No. I finally got too big.
Okay.
Then you're just wrestling monsters. And I had to, you know, I stopped. But that was really the only kind of athletic thing I tried.
I stuck with cross country and track from 7th to 10th grade because that involved no hand-eye coordination. You just run. Mm. But even then, I mean, bless my heart, I was like 57th in every race,
right.
You know, vomiting because I was
but
so
it's
nervous.
Good. I mean, it's good for you and for me, and it's good for kids to find out, like, okay, that is
not for
my
me.
Path. It's
exactly.
not for me. I need to do another thing.
Exactly.
You know? Because I got cut from 9th grade baseball, like the first guy to get cut. And I worked hard mm-hmm. and did all this stuff. You know, you have to run down the balls. And if I hustle enough, then coach, quote unquote, he'll see me and whatever. You know, and I'm like the first guy to get cut. Like
Aww.
No hope whatsoever.
Aww.
So, you know, you just as a guy, I think you're hanging in there for a while because that's the track you're supposed to be on, I guess. You're supposed to try to be an athlete and have people like you.
Exactly.
And it's just, you know, you got kind of beaten in the head and go, okay, guys, I don't listen to coach anymore, okay? I don't have a coach.
I wish people could have seen the air quotes you were just doing.
Yeah, I'm just doing coach. I always air quote coach because I know a lot of people have wonderful athletic experiences and a lot of probably coaches out there
that shape their life,
that
shape who they are,
people's lives and are a positive influence on young men and women.
Right.
You know, so far I haven't run into them
very
much, so I've used air quotes.
Yes.
Thanks a lot. Coach.
Yes.
But we find our path, and by
you do.
And by the end of high school and into college, you and I did in our different ways.
Exactly.
So political science, because you were sort of going to become a lawyer. When did that?
Well, I started applying to law schools. Well, senior year, I signed up to take the LSAT, and then I kept postponing it because I just didn't have time to study, as in I was partying, but I still, if I'd really wanted it, I know I would have put the effort in, put it that way. You know, I felt like, oh, I'm so busy with senior year, again, busy partying, but I just didn't want to take the test. I didn't want to put the time in. I started applying for law firms in D.C. and wasn't getting a job. And then my parents, my dad's office building, randomly, there was a reality show. There was a show. Okay, so the Senior Bowl happens every year in Mobile. And so they had a reality show about trying to get a sports agent. It was only on 1 year. And they used my dad's office building to shoot some of the scenes. And this whole crew came in from L.A. and moved furniture and came in and set up cameras. And my parents called me and they said, we think you could really get into this. And all these people live in LA. We really think, you know, you've always wanted to be in entertainment. Maybe you should try LA. So it was really my parents' idea for me to go to LA.
Now, when you were, when the Mary Patterson, the lawyer, was floating out of your head.
Right.
Do you think, was it like, I'm just enjoying going to parties and being lazy? Or was there something in your heart just going, hey, MP, this isn't happening. You don't want to be a lawyer.
It was that. It was more that. And I was also kind of the token entertainer in my sorority. I would always stand up and tell stories and make people laugh or in Rush and that sort of thing. And so I kind of started to get the feel for comedy and thought I wanted to do sketch and improv. Mm-hmm. So I thought, I'm just going to move to LA and work in comedy. I wouldn't even admit to wanting to be a performer anymore.
Yeah.
I thought I'm going to be involved in comedy, whether it's getting a job at Comedy Central or working on a show, just somehow in that way. That's kind of the conclusion I came to. But yeah, the lawyer thing, I think I knew deep down it wasn't
for
me.
So you just moved to LA?
Yeah,
after that show, you know, the show, and you found it, and the cameras and everything, and sort of the excitement.
Yeah, it was their idea. I would have thought maybe New York, but I decided on LA because I just thought there was more work.
So mom and dad, the lawyer, what did mom, do anything? Was mom a housewife? Did she work?
She's a homemaker.
Homemaker.
Volunteered. Dad, lawyer, sometimes work part-time.
In Mobile. But mom and dad say, you know, MP, you ought to move to LA.
Well, they remembered my Annie Oakley days, you know, and people were still talking about my Annie Oakley.
So they were still fans of Annie Oakley, and they go, you got to get out.
They were like, you've always wanted to be a performer. You've always loved entertainment. You should just give it a try. So, yeah, they encouraged it.
That's great.
Yeah, and they're still super supportive.
That is tremendous.
Yeah.
Tremendous.
Very lucky in that way, for sure.
Because so many people's parents, you know, especially young people, getting out of college. I mean, they talk to me after a show. They go, my son, he's 20 and he just wants to be an actor or whatever. And I keep telling him not to. Don't tell him not to. I mean, he's got to do what he's going to do.
Right. You know? Exactly.
So support him. Support him.
Yeah. No, they've been very supportive because they know that's all I've ever wanted to do. Sure, I've gone through phases when I denied it and thought, oh, I'm not good enough or I'm not going to. But, you know, I've just stuck with it because I can't, you know, I don't want to do anything else.
So you got to L.A. relatively inexperienced.
Oh, yeah.
At any of this. I mean, you just came.
I knew two people. I packed up my car, drove by myself on the 10 from Mobile to L.A.
I saw these guys shooting a reality show at Dad's office.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm just going to do something around that.
Exactly.
And I'm driving to L.A.
Yeah, I got a job as a page at CBS.
Uh-huh.
So I got to work on Price is Right and Craig Ferguson and, you know, we would seat audience members for that.
Sure.
So I got to work at a big studio lot, which is really cool when you're brand new to LA, uh-huh. You know, 22 years old. So
what do you do as a page on the Price is Right?
You write the name tags.
You wrote the name tags?
I wrote name tags for Price is Right. Yes. And I high-fived Bob Barker at one point.
You did?
Yeah, because you get to stand in as they tape the show. You stand at the bottom of the stage and you help people
up
the stairs. You stand in the back. The whole seating is a whole all-day thing. They have to show up at 6 in the morning.
Right.
You know, they have to sign up and then they come back and see if their number got chosen. They literally weave their way around the building for hours. Producers come out and interview them. Yeah, it's a whole thing. And so pages coordinate that. And so it was a very fun, entertaining way to, like, you know, start my career in LA, you know, talking to these audience members. And you feel very cool at the time. You know, you feel.
Right.
And then you work in the guest relations department answering the phones. And you send. Back then, they were still sending paper tickets to anybody that would write in.
Right.
You know, at the end of the show, it used to say, do you want to be a contestant on The Price is Right? Write in to 9700 Beverly Boulevard, Los Angeles, California. And so we would get that mail with people asking for tickets, and we had this whole archaic typewriter of like typing out the address and putting in colored tickets.
Oh yeah.
And sending them off to people all over the country.
But you high-fived Bob Barker.
I did high-five.
Was this after or before he did the spay and neuter your pets thing?
He wasn't doing that when I was working
there. Spaying neuter your pets. Was he a dark-haired Bob Barker or white-haired Bob Barker? Cuz that happened like overnight.
White.
That was overnight.
He
did not age. No, it was he just went like, yeah, forget the Grecian formula. Boom, I'm going white. Bang.
Yeah. This was white-haired Bob Barker. This was right before he retired.
Did you know Bob Barker was a black belt in karate?
I didn't know that.
Yes, he was. He used to go on talk shows and break boards and stuff many years ago.
Before he was a successful television host?
No, while he did it.
Really?
While he did it.
He
broke boards. I think on The Tonight Show. Or some, I remember, it might have been some, you know, the Mike Douglas show or Dinah Shore or some kind of off-brandish talk show. But Bob Barker came on to talk and everything and then put on a karate uniform and breakboards.
Well, you know, he's my neighbor.
He what?
Because I live right at the bottom of the Hollywood Hills at Franklin, sort of, and he lives on Outpost Drive. I've seen him taking his dog out, not once, but two times.
High five either time? No, you just saw. You know, I'm not going up to high five him.
No, I didn't. I didn't want to stop him and freak him out and be like, hey, I was a page. Remember that time we high fived? I didn't do that.
Right.
I just jogged past, acknowledged the fact that I live in the same neighborhood as Bob Barker.
So, you know, when you're out there and you get a job as a page and you just want in, mm-hmm. you know, you're kind of like, I'm doing a page or I'm going to do this job and find out about the production. You know, stand up, as you know, I mean, that's a pretty big decision. Of going like, I think I'm going to get on stage and start telling my funny thoughts.
Well, I wasn't, you know, again, I was going to do sketch and improv, but before I had a chance to sign up at Groundlings, wherever I was going to do it, I met some girls who had taken a stand-up class. And I just thought, they were like, you know, she's looking to have it start a new class. You should do it. It's all females. And I was like, okay, I've always been a good storyteller. Sure, I'll do it. And then while taking that class, I went to a show at the Improv called Pretty Funny Women.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, before Chelsea Handler had blown up, she was headlining that show. There's a lot of other women that are now have gone on to be pretty successful. And my teacher produces that show, or my teacher, my former teacher. And so I saw them all on stage and I thought, I can do that. I want to do that. I want to do that. And the rest is history. I took the class and started doing open mics and, you know.
Open mics where, in L.A.?
All over L.A., yeah.
Every
in
kind
Orange
of
County, and yeah,
deli or
yeah, my first set ever was at the Unurban Cafe on Pico in Santa.
And that's
Monica.
A famous kind of alternative comedy venue.
The Unurban Cafe. The you're thinking of Uncabaret.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. Yeah. You're right. Unurban Cafe. I've actually done.
Have you?
I've actually done the Unurban. Yeah,
yeah, that was
yeah,
my
as
first
music,
time on
as
stage.
Music, because sometimes, well, sometimes even now, a friend and I will go to the Unurban to the open mic and just be, you know, be folk singers.
Yeah.
And just sing and play. It is what it's very kind of.
That's how you know
eclectic.
You love it, though, right? I mean, I still just, you know, I love performing still. I mean, there's still certain open mics I go to. Not that I'm so past beyond open mics, but that I've been going to since I started, just because it's, you know, safe space to try stuff.
I think it's great and safe. And it just, I go there almost nostalgically.
Yeah.
You know, that ideal. When
a
you look
bit.
Off of the stage and you just see, you know, a small number of people in a coffee house
yeah.
with the window of the storefront
yep,
and the traffic
exactly.
going by.
Have you ever been to Hallenbeck's?
I sure have.
Yeah.
I played Hallenbeck's before a number of times.
Yeah.
yeah. It is that thing. It's just a tiny little place
yeah.
with cars driving by and a kind of almost naked light bulb thing. But I like going there. Sometimes you're just like, boy, this is where I started. This
it is.
How
it
is.
That was my second open mic, and I still go there occasionally. And I told the guys there, I'm like, I'm working professionally now. It's awesome. I feel really good.
Yeah.
You know, but I still be able like to come back here and continue to work on the new stuff.
Now, how you told me that you worked at an agency that represented comedians.
Right.
How did that happen?
Well, I met a girl in the stand-up class who worked for this agent. And at the time, after CBS, I got a job. I was a personal assistant for like a month. That didn't go well. And then I worked at a production company out of a guy's house. And you actually might know. Do you know who Michael Young is?
I don't think I do.
He hosted Kids Are People Too. Back in the 80s.
It is L.A., so if I see him, I will call him Pally. Say, hey, Pally, how's it going? Because that's what Dean Martin did.
Right.
So I don't want anyone to know that I don't remember working with them.
Right.
But I will see Michael Young and say, hello, nice to meet you. And I go, what are you talking about? We did a show for 8 episodes. And I'll get off going.
Yeah, he was an actor. I thought maybe, but
of
no,
course.
Anyways. I worked at a production company. So when I started taking the stand-up class, I was working there. And my friend, Danielle Stewart, a very funny comedian, was taking the class and working at an agency, and they weren't happy with their current assistant. She said, you know, if you want out of this production job, I can get you a job at the agency. You'll learn about comedy. You'll get to know headliners. You'll make contacts in the business.
Did that actually end up happening?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Because that's interesting, because you're trying to be a comedian.
Well,
and
every
a job
day,
opens for in an agency that represents big-time comedians.
Exactly. And so every day I would drive to work in Santa Monica from Hollywood for 5.5 years and then do stand-up at night very steadily, just kept doing my stand-up at night and doing that job during the day. And I did. I made relationships with a lot of headliners that I'm really close to now, and got to know bookers all over the country, learned a ton about how the business works. So much more than some people my age that haven't had that exposure to it in that way.
I will grill you on it, but is there a thing that you think young comedians are missing? That where you're working there and you're thinking, you know,
it actually works this way, and not in the way that everyone thinks.
Well, a lot of young comedians don't get a personal appearance agent. They don't understand that it's the final frontier, that a personal appearance agent is for people that make enough money to where it's worth their time. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people would say, oh, you work, why don't they represent you? I'd say, because I'm not a headliner. I don't make money. A lot of people my age don't get the agency dollar signs, and they just, they have to sell you.
They really don't, do they?
They just think, hey, I'm funny.
And
right?
I think, and that's, like, it's very, like,
that's
true.
The minimum you need to be.
And I think that that's true of actors as well.
Yeah.
Actors and comedians and young. And look, and I was there, and I understand.
Right.
Because you're a young person, and you're thinking, don't you understand? I'm good.
Yeah.
And the agent is looking at you and saying, I know you're good. All I think about is, can I sell
exactly.
you for money?
Exactly.
Because that's why I'm here, to sell you for money.
Right.
And if I can't see a way that I can do that, you know, then great, but you're not even going to be happy having, you know, me as an agent, because
yeah,
I can't do anything.
They don't get that it's not just about being funny. Obviously, that's very important, you know, and that's going to carry you the longest if you have a solid, you know, foundation. But, you know, some of our clients have a ton of credits and they still, you know, had a hard time selling at some points in their career and that kind of thing. So they're not just going to sign anybody. So I guess, yeah, a lot of people don't get that what we did, having a live agent, having a personal appearance agent, is really when you've got representation in every other way and you've gotten to a point where you're selling so many tickets that you need somebody to, you know,
right,
negotiate
to get you
for
theaters
you
and stuff. Like,
exactly.
Not a big long list, but who's representative of those kinds of people that that agency would represent? Like the big comedian who sells lots of tickets.
We have Artie Lang.
Uh-huh.
He sells a lot of tickets.
Right,
we used to have Tracy Morgan until very recently.
Uh-huh.
We did. I'm not presently working there anymore. I don't want to speak in present terms. You know, Richard Lewis, Susie Essman.
Mm-hmm.
They both kind of do clubs and theaters. And then some acts that he's building include Steve Ranazzisi, Joey Diaz, Ari Shaffir.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, I learned a lot about, you know, the younger agent at the agency where I worked is all about the podcast. And we were talking about this before
we started
recording. And, you know, looking forward to, it's not just about film and TV anymore. Have these people built fans?
Right.
And can they continue to build fans, you know, through the social media, through the podcasting, that kind of thing. So I learned all about that, too. Just, you know, the importance of coming in with new content if you're going to build fans and, you know, the importance of getting email addresses if you can at the venue so you can go in somewhere and know, you know, I've got this many people that came to see me in this market, and when I go back, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So that's what you just left there, what?
2 weeks ago.
I am
a brand new full-time artist.
So you worked there, you learned what you could learn.
Yep.
You know, you made your money in order to pay bills, but you've made the decision, well, you made the decision a while ago, but
yeah.
2 weeks ago, you started to be a professional.
I quit.
Yes, a professional comedian.
Yep.
Traveling around and paying all your bills and making your money from doing shows.
Yep. Yep.
Which is incredibly gutsy. So I congratulate you.
Thanks.
You know, you're 2 weeks in. You've been working a while, but how's it going?
It's going well. It's going well. I felt like the days that I was in LA, I was very productive. And now that I'm on the road, it's so nice. When I was working that job and on the road, I would have to answer work emails and be worried about stuff falling through the cracks when I was gone. And now I can get up and, you know, do a video project for a podcast I'm doing. I can listen to my sets. I can write. I can write a blog. I can, you know, work out as long as I want. It feels very like I'm focused on being the CEO of me.
Uh-huh.
So it feels great. So far, so good.
So far, so good.
Yes.
But you've, you know, as we both know and everyone, I mean, stand-up comedy is an incredibly competitive.
Yes.
And let's even say, you know, backbiting profession. I mean, everyone is after your gig. I mean, when I talk to young comedians, I compare it to a pirate ship. I say you cannot climb aboard a pirate ship and then complain if somebody takes your stuff while you're sleeping and stabs you. It's
yes.
a pirate ship. You know,
I've never thought about it like that, but thank you.
You know, well, we've
for
all
that vision.
Well, it's the same thing with actors. It's the same thing in anything in show business. You know, we decided, you know, we could have gotten a job at a cubicle or one of those fancy ships where guys boss us around and everything, and you
yeah.
just get
everybody's
your meal.
Everybody's working for the weekend.
Exactly.
One of those.
But we looked across the harbor mm-hmm. and saw this. Well, look at that ship over there.
There's gold with the
jolly rod. Exactly, with a jolly rod with skull and crossbones. Well, that looks kind of cool. And,
yeah.
And the guys and gals, they're swashbuckling. And they have, you know, red scarves blowing in the breeze. And so we climb aboard. And immediately we go, wow, this would be great to ride in. And then, you know, within time we go, hey, wait a minute. This is a pirate ship.
Yeah, but, you know, don't you try to think, you don't want to think like, you want to think there's room for everyone.
There is room for everyone.
And you want to think that just because somebody's gotten something, it doesn't mean you're not going to get
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely times when I feel like I'm doing something wrong if I haven't. Because I'll see other, especially I feel like I compare myself more to women. If I see another woman who's accomplished something and I just think, well, they've been doing it less time as me, or they don't, I guess I'm not as funny. I'm not that funny, but I have to like block that out.
But man, that's the big, well, we all have to block that out,
you know?
I mean, I think everyone, probably business people or orthodontists or whomever,
so they
think,
say,
well, that guy, I met that guy at a party and he's, you know, wow.
You think everybody does that?
I think everybody does that. I mean, I think it's that poisonous comparison
I know.
That everyone has, that if we do it to, look, it's natural, it's human, but it's going to kill you because there's going to be somebody who comes up. But we all, I think, for me, just like, look, I'm on my path.
Yeah,
I'm doing
nobody
my
is
thing.
You.
Nobody's me. And I'm just doing it the way I do it.
That's true.
And as we talked about before, yeah, before we started recording, hey, we win. We're doing, you know, what we want to do,
right?
And not, you know, at some convention trying to sell widgets.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I still have moments when I, because all I've ever wanted to do since I was a little girl is entertain people, and so when I even just featuring, you know, these, I pinch myself before I go, I can't believe I'm getting paid to do this. I can't believe I'm fulfilling this, you know. And I've gotten to where I've just decided, I've got to be happy every day doing what I'm doing, and I can't wait for some big thing to happen, or, you know, I've just got to enjoy it because I might not ever be rich and famous doing this. So I've just got to enjoy it, you know,
mm-hmm.
as it is now.
Right. What are the challenges of doing what you're doing? I mean, are you featuring a lot?
Yes, that's primarily road. What I'm doing. So I don't have any credits.
Yeah, a lot of comedians would understand, a lot of people, but some people don't. It's comedy used to not be that way. It used to be you never know who was in the show, 4 people, 5 people, 2 people.
Yeah.
But it's really come into a thing where it's an opener who's usually locally around
right.
here at our show. It's
right.
a local gentleman from Kansas City.
Right.
And he comes up and does the 15 minutes and opens the show and welcome
uh-huh.
and how many birthdays and,
right.
and does some
yeah.
and does a show of his own, which
yeah.
is very good. And then the feature entertainer comes on before
yeah.
the headliner, you do about 25 minutes.
Yep.
And then I come up and do whatever, 45 to an hour.
Right.
About
that's pretty
that.
The standard now.
Right. So you're featuring across the country.
Right.
But as we said, you know, in the pirate ship, though, as you know, there are guys who are just driving all over the country, you know, doing it really cheaply
mm-hmm,
for
mm-hmm.
kind of free beer
mm-hmm.
and meeting women or something.
Right.
That are, if I may be honest, terrible comedians.
Right.
But out there in the business, they can sell it.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
they're kind of cheap.
Right.
And they're driving to South Dakota from North Carolina.
Right.
And they won't cost a plane ticket. So, I mean, that's a part of the competition within feature comedians that I just say, wow, that's... You know, I mean, they have their own level of competition that headliners, many
yeah.
people, you know, want to knock me off or charge less money or do whatever
yeah,
in order
yeah.
to get the gigs that I have.
Right.
So it's always, I think, dog eat dog.
Yeah.
And we always have to kind of keep doing our thing.
Yeah.
And keep moving forward and doing the show that we do.
Yeah, I think you've got to decide, you know... I wouldn't want to do that. I wouldn't want to drive to South Dakota from North Carolina.
No, I don't think anyone would, except the guy who just says there's going to be free beer.
Right, but I mean, if I'd wanted to, I could have moved somewhere that was easier to, you know, it's hard to feature out of LA because obviously the features don't get paid that much, which is why I'm having to do things to supplement my income. If I moved to a smaller market, I'm sure I could just solely make a living doing stand-up and drive to a lot of my gigs, not have to pay for flights. But I have started my foundation in LA, and I have a network in LA, and that's where so much of that's where you ultimately want to end up anyways, so why do that?
But that's smart.
Right.
Because the other thing seems like, from what I see, kind of a trap.
Yeah.
If you ultimately want it to be above that.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're going to get safe and you're going to make your money
exactly.
doing the seven places that you play and kind of interchanging exactly. them and driving around a 500 or 700 mile radius. And go, well, I could go to New York or LA, but I have to make money.
Yeah. That's, you could easily fall into that.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know. I would still like to do, you know, acting things and writing things.
Annie Oakley is still alive.
Annie Oakley is alive and well.
Ask your mom and dad.
Alive
first
and
of
well.
All.
Okay.
Well, you can. Like, what things are you doing now? And I didn't mean to be preachy about about what we're all doing and following our vision or whatever.
Oh, you weren't
but
preachy
I think
at all.
That, I think that comedy, you know, I think I meant it in an admiring way towards
mm-hmm,
you
mm-hmm.
that even seeing the business, working at an agency, knowing what it is, knowing how competitive it is, you thought to yourself, I have a voice, I have something
yeah.
to say, I'm good at this, and I'm able to go to Kansas City and LA and where and who knows where.
Yeah, yeah.
Everywhere and do this and be a success at it, which I think you certainly can and are doing it, you know, before my eyes.
Well, you know, it's interesting because working at that job had a lot of benefits, but it also had a lot. It is kind of scary to see the reality of the business because I do know so how hard it is, and I see people that have been at it way longer than me that have a million credits and you know, they've got their ups and downs. So yeah, I easily could have taken that and been like, you know, this is not. But the other part of me had this sense the whole time I was working there, like, I still want to be talent. I really want to be talents,
right.
And also just got to be really hard working for people doing what you want to do. So ultimately, I had to, you know, make the choice, but you know, as far as the acting stuff goes, I think I always deep down have wanted stand-up to kind of lead to those things. And, you know, I've gotten a commercial agent in the past couple years, and I'm taking some classes. I'm on the waiting list at Groundlings, you know.
What kind of classes are you taking?
I've taken tons of improv, but I've started at Margie Haber. I did, like, intro to on-camera audition technique, which
uh-huh.
is something I had never done
uh-huh.
in all my years in L.A. So just stuff like, you know, I just need some basic sort of training. With acting, I haven't really had any formal training. I've just done stand-up and taken improv classes.
Mm-hmm.
So
Did you learn from the improv classes, or was it mostly getting up on stage and just doing it?
I think they helped just because so many commercial auditions now call for improvising, and I think they've helped my stand-up. And they're just fun and enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what I learned in terms of acting technique, but that's why sometimes during that class, the teacher would give some sort of critique like, well, that's a more of an acting note. And I think I need to take some acting classes. I
huh.
need to
yeah.
get some training.
And I don't mean disrespect because I know there are a lot of improv classes and many of my friends have benefited them.
Right.
I have never taken one. I mean, I've done, you know, tons of improv from early, but there kind of weren't classes.
Yeah,
you just
yeah.
kind of kept doing it. And so I've always wondered like what, you know, I can't imagine if I was teaching improv, like what an improv teacher says.
Oh, well, I mean, there's all kinds of rules
scene.
And, you know, formulas and that sort of thing.
But isn't that
do's and
kind
don'ts.
Of, well, it, yeah. But isn't that against the spirit of the whole thing?
Yes and
I can
no.
agree. I can agree with the thing of improv, which is whatever it is, agree, and add,
mm-hmm.
and whatever, those things.
Mm-hmm.
Just don't negate
exactly.
the person. You
yes
know, because
and.
That,
mm-hmm.
Because yes, when you're early at improv and you're prepared in your head to do a scene at a pizza shop,
right.
and somebody says, look, we're flying with Magical, and you go, wait,
no, we're not.
We're in
yeah,
a pizza,
we're
shop.
A pizza shop.
You know,
yeah,
of course,
yeah. Don't do
of
that.
Course,
yeah.
that's wrong. But other than that, there are more rules than that?
Yeah, there's
way more rules.
Boy, yeah, like at Groundlings, they say, you know, you start a scene with emotion, eye contact, and space work, you know, immediately, you know, build the scene. How are you carrying it for all kinds of stuff? I mean, you know, but it's also more just about doing it, just, you know, in the classes, getting the practice, like putting the time in. But, you know, again, improv's never going to be my thing. I've obviously put way more focus into stand-up, but that's kind of been my way to continue to try to hold on to the acting thing a little bit, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But I think you're kind of inclined and drawn to do what feels so. When I took improv classes early on, rather than going and hanging out at Iowa West, I didn't really want to do that. When I took stand-up classes, when I started doing stand-up, I never got sick of going to the improv or going to the store and seeing
shows.
Well,
that's interesting.
You know?
That's interesting.
I don't get sick of stand-up somehow. I don't, you know.
And that the improv theaters, you were like, all right, I'm done. Like, I took the class.
Yeah, I took the class and it just didn't really
hang out here or whatever.
Right. Groundlings is a little different because you get into kind of the characters sooner and it's going to be the next level. More of like writing, you know, like mm-hmm. monologue writing, whereas the other schools is just the making up as you go along for six levels.
Are you kind of following a path to a goal that you have, or are you, like through college and like through driving to LA, are you still just learning what the path is as you go?
I'm learning what the path is as I go. I mean, yeah. I want to write, act, and do stand-up. I mean, that's all I know, really.
You want to write and act and do stand-up?
Yep.
Ideal in 10 years, what would you love to have happen?
Oh, that's such a hard question. I don't
know. I mean, is it writing a movie that's, you know, that gets a lot of notice?
I think it would be cool. No, I think I'd be better at writing for like a variety type show. So either a late night show or a Chelsea Lately type of show. I think I'd be better at doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd love to have that kind of career where I could write and perform in a show and do stand up.
Well, I'll bet it happens.
I hope so.
Well, you're smart.
I hope so.
You're smart and talented. Well, that's great. Thanks for coming on. I mean, I think it's going to work out because I mean, you're the first person I think I've worked with on the road that I found interesting and talented.
Really?
And
the first erudite. One?
I think you're the first one. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I've worked with many, many talented comedians,
mm-hmm.
but I think that there is, in comedy, it can be difficult and it can wear on people. And there is often, I feel, a lack of freshness
mm-hmm.
about mm-hmm. the eyes of the comedian mm-hmm. when I speak with them at a club.
Right, right.
They're jaded. Some things haven't worked out for them.
Yeah.
They're sadder than they were 3 years ago.
Right.
And yes, our society or parts of the culture are fascinated with that.
Mm-hmm.
They love that stereotype mm-hmm. of the sad clown thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And they will go for that. I find that uninteresting and uncharacteristic of many comedians that I know.
Yeah.
Many who have life in their eyes,
yeah.
who've come here with a certain energy and excitement
yeah.
in order to follow a path in their life that's gutsy
mm-hmm.
and artistic, you know, and then say, look, I didn't mind getting up in front of people when I was in school and saying something. And
yeah.
guess what? I still have something to say.
Right.
But anyway, Mary Patterson, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Well, tell us your information, would you?
Yeah, my Twitter handle is at Mary Patterson B.
Mary Patterson B.
Yes. Uh-huh. I have my own podcast called Homeo and Juliet. It's on iTunes. And my website is uppermiddleclassangst.com.
Excellent. What's your podcast about? Like, does it have a theme?
Homeo and Juliet, it's my best friend and I, and we just banter about being artists in LA, and he's a aspiring screenwriter and sitcom writer, and I'm the stand-up comedian, and we just talk about our lives, and then we interview artists and writers and people we think are interesting.
I hope he's far less of an egocentric blowhard than I am.
Oh, please.
Because at the end of ours, I'm thinking, oh, Tom, why did you
oh,
go
oh, my
into
God,
thing
please.
We're all insecure too, right? So when
we're
I go
comedians.
Off,
we all love ourselves and love talking about ourselves.
Exactly. But then within 30 seconds of talking about ourselves, there is a voice in my head going, oh, shut
oh, please.
Up.
I regret saying, people always listen to me when I talk. That was ridiculous. Why did I say that? Why did I
Isn't
say that?
It's just fun. You know, just our brain, how our brains work is just amazing.
I know.
How we just say, you know, we do the best we can and just go, well, that wasn't very good.
Mm. Yep. Want to change a lot of that.
just it's the feeling of an actor driving home from an audition.
Oh, yeah.
It's just driving there.
Or driving home after a set that, right. You know.
You're just driving there just full of hope and working on this thing. Yeah, I worked on that. And I think I have that kind of those four sentences memorized. So I'll probably do that pretty well, you know. And then just driving home and why did I ever think I would come and be an actor here?
You still have that now? What?
Oh, yeah.
No, you don't have that now.
Sometimes I do. Most of the time, yeah, you have to learn that that will drive you absolutely crazy.
Oh, yeah.
So I had that for years. So it was a lot of self-talk of going, dude, that is going to kill you. Forget about it. Just all you can do is go up to the plate, swing the bat as hard as you can, and then go sit down.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's going to be a home run.
Sometimes.
You know, plenty of times you're going to strike out.
Yeah.
So just go sit down, wait for the next time, and just and forget about it. But it is hard to do.
Yeah. Well, I think the more I do it, the more I just come to terms with, yeah, it's, I used to, if I had a bad set, be like, I'm quitting. This is useless. I'm going to apply to law school. Maybe I could get a job in my hometown. I have all these thoughts. And now I'm just like, the more often I do it, I'm like, yeah, they're not going to all be gyms. Not everyone's going to be your audience. You know, but I'd like to get to a point where I kill everywhere I go, no matter what. But I don't know if that's possible. I don't know.
I'm not sure it is. You know, you just get different audiences. But hey, look, I take great comfort in. I saw an interview with Jack Lemmon,
mm-hmm.
famous, spectacular actor movie star of decades.
Yeah,
and he was an older man,
mm-hmm.
and he said, "Yeah, after every movie, I go home and I think, well, that's it. That's it. They saw through me." I was
really?
I was terrible in that, and they finally see, and nobody's going to come after me again for a movie because that it was that bad. So I thought, well, you know, everybody does that.
Oh, God. So it doesn't go away. Lovely.
It doesn't go away, except oddly in the people I think who aren't very good at all. Interestingly.
Yes.
Interestingly, I think they have a wonderful gene
of not being in their head.
Right.
Of not being in their head.
And just saying, I am simply magnificent. And, you know, and everyone needs to understand that. I'm amazed that no one has so far, but I'm just going to continue. Just, wow, that would be great to try.
Yeah.
You know?
I don't think I'll ever have that.
Me neither. Me either. I got to erase most of the stuff I said in this. Thanks. Well, thanks so much to Mary Patterson. She is a tremendous young comedian, and I appreciate her time a lot. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to Chris and Katie, everybody over at Nerdist Industries for their help. Thanks to McPherson Guitars for helping me out here in Kansas City on my live show. And thanks to you especially. Please, hey, would you consider subscribing to the podcast or telling a friend about it? I sure appreciate your feedback. And hey, we'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Leaving Nerdist.com.